that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KVOO Portland. Thanks for tuning in. Up next, we have The Bike Show, which brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. Don't forget, all of these programs, all these KVOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kvoo.fm or use your mobile app and click on donate. And now this. Thanks for tuning in.
And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Tune in Saturday, August 10th for a special edition of Grateful Dead and Friends from noon to 2 p.m. The show will be broadcast live from Bloom Garden Supply for their annual summer party, featuring food, drinks, and giveaways. Sun will be hosting and playing tunes from the Grateful Dead and Legion of Mary. Again, that's Grateful Dead and Friends live from Bloom Garden Supply on Saturday, August 10th at noon here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon at 90.7. My name is April Streeter and I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Tori Bortman. Good morning, Tori. How are you?
Good morning, April. I'm doing great.
In today's show, we'll explore whether there's a second golden age of bicycling around the corner or in our near future. In the first half of the show, we'll talk with documentary filmmaker Liz Canning on her new movie, Motherload. In the second half of the hour, we'll talk to Brandy Horton of the Rails to Trails Conservancy about the growing possibility for an interlinked cross-country trail system and how that might boost biking's second golden age. Before we introduce Liz, a few quick news items from the cycling universe. First off, a bit of sobering reality. The Wall Street Journal reported that since January 2000, more Americans have died in car crashes than in both world wars put together. 624,000 people were victims of stupid driving, distracted driving, drunk driving, and/or speeding drivers. In the two wars, just 535,000 American military personnel died for comparison. And between 2006 and 2015, 100,000 Americans died from opioids. In that same time frame, 119,000 died in car crashes. Thus far, the surprising thing the article points out is that there hasn't been more social outrage in this country about this issue.
Next, international authority and local Portland State University professor Jennifer Dill says cycling is a gendered activity. In a field experiment, Dill and her researchers found drivers were significantly more likely to encroach, meaning pass too close, closer than 3 feet, on female-identified rather than male-identified cyclists. There are a few takeaways from Dill's field experiments, and we'll put a link to her study on our Facebook page. But here's a direct quote. The finding that surprised and concerned the county's Bicycle Advisory Task Force concerned differences in vehicle passing distances based on the gender of the cyclist. Overall, mean passing distance for the female rider was 68 inches, 3 inches less than the mean for the male riders, which was 71 inches. And of the 33 encroachments that occurred, 24, or 73%, were on the female rider. Statistical modeling showed that, other factors being equal, the female cyclist was 3.8 times more likely to be encroached upon than the male.
And now for the uplifting bike tale. 73-year-old Gregory Randolph was rescued near death by distance mountain biker Tomas Quiñones in the high desert last week. 73-year-old Gregory Randolph, stranded for 4 days with his two dogs in the high desert of Lake County, Oregon, was rescued when a long-distance mountain biker by the name of Tomas Quiñones discovered him near death. Randolph had already hiked 14 miles with one of his dogs after his Jeep got stuck in a dry creek bed. On his bike, Quiñones of Portland had not seen anyone all day when he suddenly spotted Randolph. As I got closer, I thought, that's a funny-looking cow, and then I realized that this was a man, he said. Randolph was horribly sunburned, couldn't talk or sit up, and could barely drink the water Quiñones offered. With no cell phone signal, Quiñones pressed the SOS button on a GPS tracking device, yay for GPS, and unfurled his tent to provide shade as they waited. An ambulance showed up an hour later. Quiñones and a police deputy found the truck and another dog that survived by drinking water from mud puddles in the creek bed. Randolph is now home and recovering, as are the dogs. Quiñones said he feels lucky that he found Randolph when he did and that he had a way to summon help.
In another spot of bright news, under the leadership of our own Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer, the House last week introduced the Bike Share Transit Act of 2019, proposing to allow bike share programs to be eligible for federal transit money and for grants dedicated to improving air quality. If approved, the law would make billions available in federal funds for bike share, which accounted for 36.5 million trips last year, according to the National Association of City Transportation Officials.
And now, our first guest today is filmmaker Liz Canning. Liz's work has screened internationally, and her awards include a Sundance Special Jury Prize. She's a lifelong bike commuter, former racer, and mother of 7-year-old twins. She just released the crowdsourced documentary Motherload, the story of her discovery of a community of cargo bikes and cargo bikers that helped her get back to biking after the birth of her twins, re-engage with her love of bikes and biking, and envision a second golden age of bicycling. Cargo bikes, by the way, for any that may want a definition, are bicycles designed for carrying large or heavy loads, first introduced in, surprise, Denmark. You might have been thinking Amsterdam or the Netherlands, at least according to Wikipedia. It looks like the cargo bike may have originally been an English idea, then expanded upon by the Danish with the Long John, and finally with the Dutch with the bakfiets, which literally means box bike. The Dutch showed that box or cargo bikes can also be ideal for carrying small children. Good morning, Liz, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So your documentary is partly a personal story of getting back to the joy of biking after the birth of your twins. As you went through that very early motherhood overload, were you already thinking or planning a documentary?
Not exactly. I was working as an editor of other people's films, other people's documentaries, and also doing corporate work. And once the twins were born, I really didn't have the brain power or energy to do the documentary stuff that I loved. I had been for a long time, I think, frustrated by wanting to direct instead of sort of birthing other people's films is kind of what editing feels like. So once the kids were there, I also sort of had like a midlife crisis of feeling like I don't have a lot of time. If I'm going to say something to the world, I better do it now. I still didn't know what I was going to do, and there are segments of the film that are built out of pieces of me just talking to the camera because I was tired and lonely and confused, and eventually they found their way into this piece, but that was not the intention until maybe we'd had our cargo bike for maybe a year.
How soon into the twins' birth after they were born did you get the cargo bike?
It took a while. I used a trailer as long as I could. I think they were 2.5.
Okay, so you were already utility biking sort of with the trailer, but
yeah,
you hadn't moved to the cargo bike.
Right. It became impossible for me to get up the hill with the trailer.
Okay.
So our hill is just so steep. So
yes,
I was
it is.
For a little while in there driving, and that made me crazy.
So in the film you talk about discovering the cargo bike community. I'm wondering, at what point in time you discovered, and also why do you think this community is still, in some ways, so hidden from the majority, from the sight of most of us?
Yeah. I mean, the kids were probably around 2 when I started doing some research, and discovered, you know, not only the bike that we eventually bought from Portland, by the way, but all these people blogging and chatting and talking about their excitement about their own cargo bikes. I was really struck by the intensity of the conversations and the sharing online. And I think that other people, and actually after I started making the piece and had like a Google News alert, I was very aware that there were a lot of articles written over the course of my making the film. There's been a lot of, even in mainstream publications, there's been plenty of stuff written about family biking and cargo bikes, and then there was the whole Emily Finch phenomenon that
right.
we talked about in the film. But usually these people are portrayed as kind of out there.
Yeah.
And a little kooky and a little bit maybe childish and having fun doing something great that is probably not for everyone.
Okay.
It rarely is there an article that's just about how practical, how much sense it makes, how much joy it gives a family, how it changes the community, you know, in a really, like, you should do this kind of way.
And for our listeners who haven't seen the film, you said you bought the bike from Portland. Where are you located?
I live in Marin.
Okay.
In north of San Francisco.
Okay. So one of the things that really struck me with the film is all the different narratives of people that we think about not being able to bike, and families with kids especially, because we think about going to the doctor and going to the dentist and doing all those errands where we assume that you absolutely have to bike. But there's also an older generation that we're finding ways to make cargo bikes work for them and as a way to live by bike instead of by car. What I found fascinating is in some of the early part of the film, you show that you had seen or you had researched and found out that humans are hardwired to need this outdoor sensory stimuli we get from a bike. And that was really fascinating to me.
Yeah. I think partly from my personal history of, you know, struggling with an eating disorder when I was young, I think I always tried to sort of disconnect myself from my feelings by sort of cutting myself off from my body. And eventually I started to figure out that I could not only acknowledge my feelings, but I could handle them if I was regularly, like, moving outside in nature. That was comforting enough and sort of put my feelings in a big world perspective that was easier for me. And I always, I think, kind of thought I was a freak that I needed this so badly, this riding my bicycle outside therapy. But when I discovered all these families that, and mothers in particular, that were comforted in a similar way, that was made me feel less crazy. Then I started to go to do some research into, you know, why is this? And that's when I learned about how old our DNA is and how we really are essentially hunter-gatherers, people whose whole lives and survival were based on living in tune with nature and dependent on their bodies being able to move through nature. And so, you know, it's built into us, and we're just are constantly denying it in this crazy culture we live in, and so we end up, you know, with lots and lots of emotional and physical problems.
Okay, well, yeah, I feel that. And the film also documents history of the first age of bicycling, as well as the innovators and the entrepreneurs who started making these cargo bikes in the U.S. And then, of course, as I heard their stories, which were fascinating, I couldn't help but notice that they were almost all white guys. I'm wondering, as you researched or went through the film, did that also strike you, or did you find any evidence of moms, non-men, and not non-white people innovating or entrepreneuring in this space?
Well, I try in the film to, like, one guy, Ian Grayson, talks about invention being a process of many people groping their way towards the same thing at one
right.
time. And I'm trying to look at the intersection of all these ideas. And, like, for instance, you know, Ross Evans of Extracycle came up with the idea for the long tail in collaboration with disabled veterans in Nicaragua, you know, where they already had trikes in the cities, but they needed something different in the more rural areas. And I could have gone into more detail about the parts that his collaborators played, but I didn't really have time. And then Ian Grayson talks about, he's the Australian who actually was building Long Tails before Ross and helped inspire Ross. He had talked about going to India, where they were already, you know, carrying huge loads on cargo bikes and had been always, probably since the invention of the bicycle, without stopping. That inspired him to create his Long Tails. There have been, throughout history, ever since the bicycle was created, people have been reinventing it in different ways. I think the story, the main story of our film, is who decided to advocate for it in the developed world, who said, this is an idea that needs to be popularized, and I'm going to push it as hard as I can. And that was primarily Xtracycle in the United States.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we focused on Ross, yeah.
Yeah, I almost ended up working for Xtracycle when a couple years after they got started, but I didn't quite make the move down to the country. That was not my path. But yeah, it was their company is fascinating.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. There was a chapter that unfortunately had to be cut in the film. This film used to be so long. There were so many things that had to be cut. But there was a chapter about all the DIY stuff that moms were coming up with in the early years, when it was harder to get your hands on the accessories needed for a cargo bike, and women were like making child seats out of milk crates and making their own rain covers and some really cool stuff. Just to make the bikes work better for them.
I remember some of that stuff. It's nice now that there are things that you can find and buy and purchase, but that was also an interesting age when we were all trying to do it,
I'm curious, leading after your question, April, did you find, Liz, that are we currently now having more companies that are women-led making things to solve those problems? Because
I think more
the bike manufacturers
have
are
women
male.
On staff.
Okay.
And I think I tell the story of Anne Marie Berenson in the film, who's the one who imported YEP. I mean, if we didn't have YEP child seats, I don't know what we would have done in this country.
Right.
And then there's also Karen Wiener of the New Wheel, who, maybe not by Portland standards, but by Bay Area standards, their bike shop kind of represents the bike shop of the future. I mean, they're very much about replacing a car and low entrance financing, and it's just a really serious bike business.
And I also love about that story as well is that the idea of having electric assist on your cargo bike and or your long tail, whatever your bike is, that electric assist is not something that's just for a very small segment of the population, but they just seem to do that without any, it's for everybody, that electric assist, is depending on what you want to do. And I thought that was inspiring from the film. But there's one other theme that we haven't yet brought out, and that is, in the film, you do really concentrate on the climate crisis and overall our human beings' paltry response. And here's a quote. We can't seem to get the fate, this is you speaking, we can't seem to get the fate of the planet in sharp focus. We need heroes. So tell us about what inspired you, or the heroes you found through making the film, and how it helped you get the planet's fate in focus.
I would say, first of all, that I think that the reaction that I got when I was, as one of the first moms in my town on a cargo bike with these two little kids, of everybody smiling at you and just the feeling that I had myself, I felt like there was more to it, that there's something about just knowing this is the right thing to do. And there's so many ways we try to fight the climate crisis, you know, recycling or cloth diapers or whatever. That is a huge compromise. I mean, it's kind of ineffectual. But replacing a car with a bike is kind of just perfect. I mean, it's just better in every way. And as far as heroes who are leading that charge, I mean, Ross, obviously, he has really dedicated his life to popularizing the cargo bike, and he's worked really hard. And dealt with a lot of backlash and a lot of failure and frustration. And same with people like Emily Finch. What an image she creates.
Yes.
She's really powerful, and the joy that she gets from it is just palpable.
And for our listeners who don't know who Emily Finch is, can you tell us a little bit more about her?
Sure. She's a mom of now 7 who does not use a car. At this point, I think several of her kids are on their own bikes, but back when I interviewed her and shot her riding in the film, she had 4 in the box, 1 on the back, and 1 on a trailer bike, and it's really quite a sight to see. She's not like a huge woman, and she's transporting all these kids without electric assist and absolutely loving it. And she got a lot of crap for it. One of the things, and it's interesting listening to your story about how cars are more likely to encroach on women riders.
Yeah.
One of the chapters in the film deals with this very thing, and the idea that drivers are way more comfortable either encroaching or just saying bad things to women who are riding. And Emily's dealt with that not only in writing but in the press, because she got a whole bunch of attention.
Oh, her blowback when she got attention was insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Renowned.
Really amazing.
Both sides of it.
And so I'm really proud of her that she has just, you know, she didn't skip a beat.
And I think one of the things that she really kind of embodies and displays in the film, and also when you see her on the street, because you do see her on the street in Portland, is she just really shows you that joy, and that joy of kind of being just out on the bike and doing whatever it is you need to do and going through town with the wind in your hair and maybe the rain on your face, but having a good time with it. So, but then there's another side, which is I feel it myself because I now live in a smaller Oregon town where lots of people come to bike for the beauty and the recreation, but about 0.1% from my anecdotal perception seem to bike to the store, the park, the farmer's market, or the post office. And so I can get periodically discouraged out there on my cargo bike. And I'm wondering...
This is a test of the National Emergency Alert System. This system was developed by broadcast and cable operators in voluntary cooperation with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Federal Communications Commission, and local authorities to keep you informed in the event of an emergency. If this had been an actual emergency, an official message would have followed the tone alert you heard at the start of this message. No action is required.
I'm definitely experienced some discouragement, but there's highs and lows still. And I would say, as far as what's happening in the world, what's happened in my town, just in Fairfax, part of what inspired me was just what you were talking about, April, the idea that everybody loves bikes, but they don't use them as tools, they use them as toys, and it has really changed. There are so many families and so many kids and many more people using bikes just to get around. And I'm very encouraged by what's happening in Europe, in the cities in particular. In the United States, it's just, you know, right now, I don't know. I think it's hard not to be discouraged.
You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcast from KBOO Studio in Portland, Oregon. We are here speaking with filmmaker and cargo biking advocate Liz Canning, who recently launched her other baby, the collaborative crowdsourced cargo bike documentary, Motherload, which I believe right now is actually playing at the Hollywood Theater as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's turn now to the optimistic side, because in the film you do your ideas shine about the fact that maybe there's going to be a second golden age of bicycling. So I thought maybe you could spend maybe half a minute or so summarizing the first golden age, and then maybe why, through doing the film, you started to see the outlines of perhaps a second golden age.
Sure. in the course of making the film, I learned a whole bunch about the history of bikes, and I had no idea how revolutionary it was as an invention and how it was the first time in history that the poor were really mobile, people who couldn't have afforded a horse. And then what it did for women was mind-blowing in terms of, you know, questioning the dress code, the corset, and the very strict etiquette as far as you couldn't go anywhere without an escort. Suddenly women were out and about and doing things that they had not been allowed to do. And this led to organizing and, in some ways, to fighting for the vote. So the suffragettes, the bikes were a big deal for them. So what I'm, one of the points I'm trying to make in the film is that right now we're in a time when, once again, we need to connect with each other and with nature and get out of all these boxes that we live in. We spend, like, Americans spend 95% of our time inside, which is really terrifying when you think about how we need to remember how important the planet is to our survival. And
yeah, people are so removed right now.
Yeah, it's scary. So to me, the timing seems perfect for, you know, people need to get out, reconnect to their bodies, reconnect to their communities, and to nature. So the bike seems like a perfect solution for that. And so the end of the film is kind of about passing the mantle on to the next generation. Like, if we can bring up kids who think of bikes as tools, who understand how valuable they are, maybe we have a chance. And one thing I'm really excited about is that we're working with Safe Routes to Schools, which is a federally funded national program trying to advocate for kids walking and riding bikes to school. And I think there are a couple other big bike organizations that may get involved, and I'm looking for a funder who would like to help us implement a nationwide campaign using the film, getting the film in front of families.
Yeah, that would be great.
So it would be great.
Now that you've launched and you're in that process, do you have other sort of follow-up ideas of where you want to go with your documentary filmmaking?
I have been tossing around an idea that I was just thought was kind of funny, and that I actually mentioned it to a film producer I was meeting with recently, and he's like, "That's great. You got to make that film." So I guess now I may try to make it. It just happened that I was realizing, because my daughter is now 11, my twins are 11 and a half, so she's showing signs of, like, being pubescent, and I'm certainly showing signs of being perimenopausal.
Oh, boy, and so tween and perimenopausal at the same time.
Yeah, so it struck me this is going to be really, really hard, but it could also be very interesting. In particular, because I think as a culture we're sort of redefining women's role, particularly in the public sphere, and we're also looking at huge reproductive rights and how central that is to women's freedom. And so I'm thinking about a personal film that would also bring in other people's stories of, you know, what does it mean when you go from being this person to that person as a woman, and men don't have the same thing going on. And I don't think we talk about menopause enough.
No, we don't.
We don't. And I have to say, I was a child that was in a home, because my mom didn't have me. She was, you know, over the hill. She was 35 when she had me. My mom went in our family, historically, we go into perimenopause early. So she was in perimenopause when I was a teenager.
Okay.
And my dad started his own business in the same year, basically.
Poof.
Oh, it was awesome. very exciting time. So, I think this is something people need to talk about, because for me, that was a very unusual experience. None of my peers were really having, but now that's going to be the norm.
Yeah. And I have a bike-related question about that, because I have two boys, and as they were becoming teenagers, they were suddenly completely uninterested in bicycles. It was at the lower, you know, they had a sort of a hierarchy of needs and a hierarchy of responses, and the car was first. If they could get a ride to someplace, that was first. If they could walk to someplace, that was second. Or, you know, we didn't have Lyft and Uber then, but then third was the bus, and then fourth and last was, if all else failed, they would take their bike. So I'm wondering if, as your daughter and your son are entering this age frame, the kind of middle school, whether their interest in biking has dropped off, or whether you still see them kind of interested in what the bike can do. And
Yeah.
Well,
I'm very lucky that because of where we live, my boy has been in this amazing mountain biking program, and he's got the bug. Like, he's just going to ride always, everywhere.
Is he part of the NYCA program?
No, so Rachel Lloyd, she was a former professional cyclocross. She was like top 10 in the world and downhill racer. And she did this thing where she'd take these boys from our school every Wednesday for, I don't know, 3 hours. And then also in the summer, I mean, he's just had amazing experiences with this woman teaching these boys how to ride mountain bikes.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's great. Now, for Stormy, it's more complicated. She's always been sort of more clingy. She'll ride to school, but she often still wants me to go with them, and she would prefer to go on my bike.
Okay.
That is something from a lot of cargo bike parents. It is sometimes hard to get them off of your bike.
Okay.
Well, I can't really blame her. I think if I had a transport on a bike from somebody, I would do the same thing.
Well, and it's a big hill.
Yeah.
Rocco doesn't pause for a second. He just flies right up the hill, but Stormy doesn't enjoy it. And so, but I'm pushing it, and it's been hard to, especially in Marin, where there's still a lot of moms who are totally willing to drive their kids anywhere, like
exactly.
to a million after school. It makes me crazy. I don't understand the willingness at all. And I've been trying very hard to say this is a family value. We ride our bikes. And
exactly.
That's what we're doing.
Okay. Well, good luck. For our local Portland, Oregon listeners, there's a screening of the Motherlode documentary we've been talking about on August 22nd, sponsored by Bend Electric Bikes at the Bend Brewing Company. And there are plenty more across the country and around the world listed at motherlodemovie.com, so take a look for those. You're listening to The Bike Show, broadcast from the KBOO Studios, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. And we've been speaking with filmmaker Liz Canning about the advent of a second golden age of biking, her documentary film, and the possibilities for cargo biking. Thanks so much, Liz, for all you do, and to all of the many co-producers who helped bring that film into existence, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks. Good morning and welcome back. You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcast from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon at 90.7, and also available after the show as a podcast. In the studio is myself, April Streeter, and my co-host, Tori Bortman. In this, the second half of the show, we're happy to talk about the possibilities of a coast-to-coast network of bicycle and walk trails in the U.S., and to have the opportunity to talk to Brandy Horton of the Rails to Trails Conservancy. In some ways, Liz Canning's ideas of the second golden age of bicycling infrastructure to give Americans more options for, as Liz calls it, freedom and connection in a gas-powered, digital, and divided world. The Great American Rail Trail, announced earlier this spring, would run 3,700 miles across 12 states and the District of Columbia. So basically, from Washington, D.C. to Washington State. The goal of this cross-country route is to connect communities by walking and biking, and the plan is to connect 125 different trails and fill in the 90 or so gaps. Here to tell us more is Rails to Trails' Brandy Horton. Brandy's also a mom trying to bring biking into her momish world, her work world. Thanks, Brandy, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I think it might be great if you started out to explain for our listeners what a rail trail is and how it differs from a regular trail.
Sure. That's one of those questions that we get all the time, and I always say that you probably have used a rail trail and you don't even know it. Rail trails were thought of, conceived of, in really the 1960s. It was as some of the railroads were starting to change their transportation patterns and their business models in response to highways being completed and really freight moving out of rail and into highways and trucking. And so all of these corridors were going unused, and communities started to see those and started to think about what could we do with the space that would keep it kind of nice and active and used versus something that just becomes overgrown and maybe not as safe of a place to be. And so communities and citizen activists started to come together to protect some of those corridors and turn them into trails. And then in the 1980s, Congress stepped in because there were so many railroads that were going out of business and railroad corridors that were being abandoned to try to use trails as a way to protect those corridors. So that introduced the rail trail. It was really the conversion of the old railroad into a trail corridor. And what makes them so lovely as multi-use walking, biking, rollerblading, you know, skateboarding paths is that they are, just like the railroad, follow a very gentle grade. So they become very accessible for a lot of different types of users, and very, you know, they're easy to kind of bring into a community because those corridors have already been established and built. And so a lot of folks, they exist in 50 states, all 50 states. There's 23,000 miles, more than really, 23,000 miles of rail trail in the country. So a lot of the biking paths that people use, the hiking paths, the walking paths, they don't even realize that they're walking or biking on a rail trail.
Yeah, in Portland or near Portland, we have the Springwater Corridor, which is a former part of a rail trail, I believe. So in that sense, then, are these rail trails maintained and kept paved and kept in good working order by all different types of entities?
You've got it, all different types of entities, depending on where you are in the country. Some are managed by state agencies, so, you know, parks or departments of natural resources. Some are managed by city entities, and some are managed by local volunteers and private organizations. And so really, that kind of local jurisdiction varies all over the country. And I think it's part of what makes the trails movement and trails so special is that people have found ways to embrace them and make them part of daily life, you know, depending on what the resources are that are around them. They're not all paved. Some are crushed limestone, some are concrete, some are paved, some are a more natural dirt surface. And again, that's really dependent on kind of local needs and local maintenance, you know, what that local maintenance looks like.
Okay. So maybe you should give us the origin story. How, I mean, you mentioned a little bit that there was some activism involved in thinking about rails to trails or repurposing rails to trails. But how did the Conservancy come about, and what was the spark that set off this idea to connect these trails and make a cross-country, coast-to-coast network?
Sure. So Rails to Trails Conservancy really was born from two guys who worked in Washington, D.C., David Burwell and Peter Harnick. And David was an environmentalist and a lawyer, and he knew about the kind of the concept of the rail trail because his mother was an activist on a rail trail in Massachusetts. And so he kind of got that spirit and learned about this concept as a way to really protect public lands and create new access to public lands for all different types of people in our country, and he caught that bug in a big way. And Peter Harnick was a biking advocate and also a conservationist and a historian here in Washington, D.C. And so they together really put together the legal framework for the rail banking law had just passed in Congress, and they were able to pick that up and get kind of the funding and have the legal backing to take this movement from a handful of rail trails across the country to scale it to hundreds at the time they both left the organization, and now thousands of rail trails. And so the Great American Rail Trail really entered in those early days. They had, the way the story goes, is that they had a wall map where they had pins, and they would track the status of different rail corridors all across the country. So when we heard of a corridor that was going into disuse or abandonment, that had a color pin. And then when there were corridors that were starting the process of rail banking or becoming rail trails, that had a color pin. And then there was the trails when they were actually completed and open, and that had a color pin. And on this wall map, they actually started to see the route of the Great American Rail Trail as it is now forming. And that was when David was a big dreamer, and that was when he said, you know, gosh, we can actually do this. If we follow this route and look at where these railroad corridors are, we can get across the country. And at that time, they knew it was going to be an incredibly challenging task to do, and there was rail basically just trying to save all the corridor that could be saved all across the country at that moment in time. And so the organization agreed on two criteria really for us to be able to commit to getting this thing done. One was that there was a viable route through the Rocky Mountains and into the West, because, you know, just like the railroad had a hard time getting through the mountains, it's not an easy, you know, landscape to cross. And then two, making sure that there was a route that was about 50% or more complete, so that it was very clear that the more tangible rail trails had been created and that the energy could be invested in closing the very difficult gaps. And we hit that threshold in 2018, and between 2018 and today, we spent a lot of time working with hundreds of state partners and local partners all across the country to truth that route, make sure that the route that we saw on paper and in our GIS data was the right route.
Making sure the map criteria was actually correct.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. That's an important thing to do.
It is. From somebody who goes into the backcountry a lot, there's things that are on maps that are no longer there, or there's things that aren't on maps that got put there that aren't on the map. So it's good to know what you're up against.
So we wanted to get that info and make sure that what we had was true, and that there was support locally to do this, and that we were putting the trail, really mapping it in places where there was interest and enthusiasm at the local and the state level to make that happen. And all that came together in May. And so here we are.
So what states will it officially go across as it's looking right now?
So the official route, it starts either in the east or in the west. You can really start it in either Washington, either part of the country. But if you start on the east coast, where I am, in Washington, D.C., you head from D.C. Into Maryland, into Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio. We're going to test my geography here.
Yep.
Indiana.
No, I'm following along with you in my mind.
Iowa. Nebraska,
okay.
Into Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and then Washington State.
So fairly far. It's a fairly far northern route.
It does head more north, and we explored a lot of different avenues. There were some routes in the early days that kind of went a little bit and looped a little bit more down and in through Kansas, and then some that tried to kind of get us a little bit further south. And really, you know, the most feasible, most direct route is the Washington to Washington route.
Okay. Yeah, I had wondered how much you had explored. Not that I think the northern route is always good because I think people wait. It's summer when we're available to go a lot of times ride a route like this. And, you know, if you get too far into summer when the mountains snow is melted, then it's sometimes too hot to be riding, you know, at sea level. And so a northern route is always nice if you're traveling in the summer.
Exactly. Before we get into how we get to make this American Rail Trail vision into an actual reality, tell us how you got involved in the work.
Well, when you introed me, you kind of hit on it a little bit. I am a mom. I'm a mom of three little boys and super active boys. And I'm also, I call myself a social change communicator. I've been working in nonprofit work and social change work for a really long time. And so I had the opportunity to come to Rails to Trails, and it was this perfect blending of what I do in my background and my passion to make sure that these very rambunctious little boys have places to play and be outside that are safe. And my I have colleagues that run the gamut. I have some colleagues here who are super avid bicyclists. I have some colleagues who are really passionate about walking and creating, you know, really safe pedestrian routes. And then we have folks, I call myself a blue square bicyclist, kind of like a blue square skier. You know, I like to do some of those distances. I like to do a nice long day ride, but I'm not somebody who's going to go seek out a mountain biking trail, like that kind of adrenaline. That's just not my thing. And so for me, the rail trail movement really is this invitation to all different types of people to get outside, and it just so aligns with my passions as a mom, my passions as somebody who cares about the environment and the outdoors, and it's a really, you know, it touches on so many aspects of our lives and society. It's a really powerful resource, and it's an unsung hero, I think, of our communities, and really a special thing to get to work on that every day.
Yeah, so in the first half of the show, we talked with Liz Canning, who has done a documentary about cargo biking called Motherload. And one of the things that she was really talking about is people's need to connect and get outside of their boxes, whether that be the box that most of us spend so much time in of our house or the box of our car that we also spend an extraordinary amount of time in. And so I do think that this kind of a connected rail trail, where it's not necessarily just for a road biker who's getting on a fast carbon bike, and it's not necessarily just for a person who bikes at all. A walker or, as you mentioned, a rollerblader could also be using these trails for recreation and getting outside. So now we come down to the nitty-gritty, though, of what are the estimates of how much stitching together these different trails into a coherent whole is going to cost, and how are we going to pay for it?
Yeah, sure. And you mentioned earlier that there's 90 gaps. There's about 90 gaps that are left to be completed. Some are bigger, especially out in the West. So as I mentioned, you know, we knew that when we were stepping into this, we were picking up the more difficult work that hadn't been tackled yet. And then there are some gaps that are small, but they are really important, right? Some trestles, some bridges, some tunnels, things that are still left to be completed and done because it takes a lot of momentum behind them to get the political and the public will to do it. So how we'll pay for it, we know we work on trail networks and connecting trail networks all over the country, so it takes a mix of public funding and private funding. So we expect a lot of federal investment through existing transportation and recreation programs that is available in all of the states where we're working will be leveraged and tapped in order to make these connections, as well as something of this scale and this magnitude really does inspire a lot of that private giving. And so we anticipate and have already seen some of that happening where people have come and said, you know, what segment of the trail can I help connect? What segment can I help build? We were able, as a result of a conversation just like that, to give $65,000 to the Cowboy Trail in Nebraska that then was leveraged to unlock a $700,000 grant from the federal government. So I think that those are the kinds of things, as people start to be inspired by the magnitude of this project, that will really start to happen. But at any scale, private and public funds are what it will take to get it done. And in terms of what it will cost, those numbers are incredibly variable. What we wanted to do first was define the route, make sure that that route was true. And now we're working in each of the states, really, to define what the state specific cost will be, because every state, you know, surface type will make an impact on what it will cost. Different issues related to, I mentioned, trestles and tunnels and kind of state of repair of any of those types of connections, those all go into what it will cost. And so the best way to really break it down is going to be at the state level. So now that the route is complete, we're actually sitting down and working with all those state partners to say, okay, what do we think the price tag is in, you know, Washington, Ohio, et cetera. So that's how we're tackling it. There's not a perfect price tag yet, but that's how we're breaking it down.
We're here with Brandi Horton of the Rails to Trails Coalition. She's speaking with us about the Great American Rail Trail, and you are tuned into KBOO 90.7 FM. So here in Oregon, we've been fighting for a thing that just got, I think, clearance and funding called the Salmonberry Trail, which is also a Rails to Trails. But that particular rail line, there aren't that many. It goes over our coastal mountains, which are much tougher than the Cascades because they are true rainforest. So there's a lot of flooding. There's a lot of trellises to be dealt with. And the rail line, when it was built, was actually called Dank, Punk, and Nasty by the people who built it, because that's how horrible it was. So, and you'd think those were some of the big hurdles to getting it going here. But honestly, the biggest hurdle in the end was that rail line now is on land, or abuts land that is privately owned. And there was quite a bit of pushback from landowners that we don't want this trail. It's going to bring people who are living outside and without a home onto it, and they're going to try to live in our backyard, and lots of other reasons. So my question to you is, we talked about money, and we talked about that, but how much of your finagling is around also needing approval from private landowners?
There are certainly portions of the current preferred route that either currently have ownership issues, where either it's not clear who owns the corridor, mm-hmm. or there are private landowners, or there are still railroad ownership, or whatever. There's a lot of that to sort through, and part of why it's so important that as we work through this route that we had the partnership in advance was to really help to build the coalitions and the community engagement that's necessary to get the support, right, to bring these trails together and to bring the Great American Rail Trail to the country. There will be some places that take longer as a result, right? Because yep. There's just a lot of negotiation.
Well, and also
and a lot of
people
aren't that need to happen.
People in very rural areas and very like you were speaking about the harder to build areas. Usually, the harder to build areas are also the harder to get to areas, which means people kind of are like usually have moved there because they want to be away from people, not because they want
That's
more
right.
people coming through their backyard.
That's right. Part of what made the Great American Rail Trail timing and why now is the opportunity moment to launch this and to get this done is that in those states, especially when we look west of the Rockies, there is a huge drive right now at the state level to increase outdoor recreation as an economic generator in the states, because there is a shift happening from extractive economies and different types of economies, and I think there's a lot of realization that the types of tourism, the types of participation in the outdoor economy that things like trails that are these really universal resources can deliver is powerful. And so that some of that is the kind of support and enthusiasm, job creation, et cetera, that will really help, I think, move some of this forward. And then, you know, to be honest, I mean, some of it is really just spending the time, listening, having the conversations, inviting the people in with the coalitions. And the more success that the trail has, the more people, even private landowners, often tend to want it. We've heard a lot of wonderful stories along the Katy Trail now in Missouri, now that it's been open for so long and there's been so much revenue in the state that's been generated, so much support for this trail, that people who really opposed it vehemently when it was first coming online 20-plus years ago now are real advocates for the trail because they've seen and understood and touched it and felt it. And that kind of enthusiasm becomes contagious.
So that's an economic benefit. I wonder if you have any examples of a health benefit that has been realized from a trail being in place for a segment of time, and then you can actually see that locally people are connecting with that trail and using it as a way to better health and well-being.
Sure. It's hard to equate it to one specific trail in quantitative matters. Qualitatively, we know and we hear all the time, right, about just increased use, increased access to the outdoors. But there are two very specific studies that are underway that really are going to get to, I think, the heart of what is the true realized public health impact when you start to build this, you know, open, accessible green space where people can be active. One is in a trail project that we're working on down in the Lower Rio Grande Valley in Texas, and it is in partnership with the School of Public Health and down there in Brownsville. And part of the emphasis there is that at the border, there's an incredible amount of poverty and chronic metabolic disease, so obesity and diabetes. And so the School of Public Health partnered with the local municipalities to say, like, we've got to inspire people, right, to get outside. We've got to find some ways to create these opportunities. And investing in that trail infrastructure really rose to the top through a lot of community engagement about what would it take to have you want to go outside. You know, I need a place to feel comfortable walking and biking. And now they're doing programming and they're doing the measurements to see what's really happening to people's health and well-being as a result of this investment in infrastructure. So it's a really promising set of research that will, I think, really help make the case for why this investment is so important. But at a broader, more national level, we know from the National Household Travel Survey, the most recent one that was released in 2017, which is a federal study, that only about 10% of the U.S. Or 50% of the U.S. population roughly meets CDC guidelines. 10% of them meet those guidelines for physical activity through walking and biking and using public transit. And so we can equate, when you have access to resources to walk and bike, we can equate that to an actual health cost savings of about $20 billion at a whole national scale. So there's a lot of evidence that when people have the ability to walk and bike, they do so, and that saves us as a nation and then individuals on their own a lot of money. So there's an economic benefit, and there's that health and wellness benefit.
I have a question kind of relating back to that land use. Do any of the railroads go through reservation land in the West?
We do. We engage with a lot of reservation land, and we are working very closely with the reservations and the local communities to make sure that everybody is a part of what that planning will be where there are gaps. One of the trails in particular is actually, it's an open existing trail in Idaho, the Trail of the Coeur d'Alene. It runs right through the Coeur d'Alene Reservation and was built in the early early stages of that trail in partnership with the tribe. And there's a lot of, I think, really good lessons that will be learned from how that work was done and how we should be really moving forward in some of the other portions. Just this week, we had a big meeting in Washington State with Washington State government officials, trail advocates, and tribal leaders to talk about some of the gaps in the state and what made sense. We did it at the Snoqualmie.
Snoqualmie.
Yes,
it's okay.
Thank you. Oh, gosh. I was so close.
It doesn't look like that when you say it. It's okay. It's Snoqualmie.
Yes, it just does not. I just couldn't get it out. But they hosted us, and so it was really just a wonderful coming together and the first of many, many meetings and conversations to really hash out, again, kind of what does some of that gap filling look like? How do we make sure that all of the right people are at the table at all the stages in the decision-making process?
And we're kind of getting short on time, but I really want to quickly ask, are you giving any consideration as you're making this, even though it's the American rail trail and it's a huge part of the European white American history, to make railroads? Well, actually the people making them were mostly white, but are we acknowledging as that comes through, because a lot of the new trails in Oregon, we're trying to also be sure we acknowledge the native lands and the tribes who own those lands before they were taken. Is the rail trail
is that part
of the conversation that's happening?
Absolutely. And as we tell the story of the Great American Rail Trail and as we tell the story of, you know, what it took to create these corridors, we want to be very intentional about telling the story of the history. All of the people and all of the challenges that existed in creating those railroad corridors and what that means. I think there's so much potential here to, I think, shed light and also to bring people together in new ways. And in new ways, it can be really healing, I think. You know, this is an incredible opportunity to show a lot of people from around the world all that makes the American landscape as powerful and as strong as it is. And that's the diversity, right, of our very many different cultures, our very many different types of people, our very many different, geographies and typographies. And there's just so much that the Great American Rail Trail, I think, will bring to the forefront in a way that is really, really powerful in telling the story of what America really is.
That's great. That sounds really good. I can't wait.
I'm excited to potentially ride across
the
country.
Well, the good news is, ladies, you can actually start using it now, and that's what we keep telling people. It's, you know, more than 50%. So there's not currently a trail path that's through, but there's a lot of open trail, and so people can start. There's already, I think it's 10. It might be 10. Connected pieces that are more than 100 miles, which is a really decent, you know, weekend trip or, you know, for some people a day ride, not for me, but for some people a day ride. But there's a lot of that that's already out there, and you can go to greatamericanrailtrail.org. We have an interactive map that shows the GIS of all the existing trails and the gaps. And so for existing trails, you can click right through there, access trail maps, and plan a trip and tell us about it. Get on social and tell us about it. We'd love to hear how people are using it.
Yeah, I got quite inspired by going to the website and watching some of the videos that showed some of the trail riding. But that brings me to one other issue, which
sure.
I just want to, we'll wrap things up, and that is, so we all have to share that trail. So is there a message that's really short that you give about how it's walkers and bikers and all kinds of different variations on that have to share?
I do, and it's what we tell everybody. be nice. Trails are for everyone.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But also there are rules, and you should know the rules for the specific segment that you're on. All of the trails locally are governed locally, and in terms of what you can do on them. So some will have equestrian access, some will allow e-bikes, some will not allow e-bikes. And so before anybody goes out and plans a segment, you should make sure to check what the rules are, all of which you can access through the open trail information on greatamericanrailtrail.org. But really the bottom line is it comes down to how we behave and how we connect with each other. And remember, you're going to meet people who are biking fast. You're going to meet people with little kids who are out there learning how to ride. You're going to meet people who maybe are on rollerblades for their first time. And that is awesome because it is a rail trail and it's going to be pretty flat.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Brandy. We really appreciate it that you could spend the time to talk to us about the Great American Rail Trail.
Well, thank you for having us. This was really fun.
Great. Okay, so you have been listening to KBOO, the bike show broadcast from our studio in Portland, Oregon at 90.7, and all our shows are available as podcasts. Check it out, bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. I'm April Streeter, and with my co-host Tori Bortman, we'd like to thank our guests, Liz Canning and Brandy Horton, for sharing their visions for a better biking world. Thanks also to our engineer, Jared, and special thanks to Chris Smith and Josh Hetrick for assistance with editing and podcasts. Stay safe out there and have a joyful ride.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Around the world at KBOO.FM, this is Jazz Lives. And this KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts featuring Taj Mahal with Mark Cohen, featuring guest vocalist Blind Boys of Alabama, Friday, August 16th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com.